thank you very much, Al, for making yourself available for this conversation. I'm Mark Gerchick, and I'm class of 73 at Amherst, and I recently wrote a book about the airline industry called Full Upright and Locked Position.
Mark, it's a pleasure to talk to you, and I certainly enjoyed the book. I'm Al Checkey. I had a period where I ran an airline, and that was from 1989 to 1996, and then I remained on the board throughout that period of the 9/11. So your book had a lot to say to me, and I think it has a lot to say to travelers and people who are interested in this vital industry. I'd like to ask you a couple personal questions, though. I mean,
sure.
The book was impersonal in the sense that you did a wonderful job describing the industry. In fact, I think I learned more from your book than I did spending 7 years running an airline.
I'm sure that's not true, but thanks.
You dedicated the book to your mother, the writer,
mm-hmm.
and you also mentioned that airlines were your first job, and you proposed on an airline. So I kind of was wondering a little bit about your life as a writer and the process that you went through writing this book, and have you written other things? And also, you clearly have a deep interest and knowledge of the industry, and I kind of wonder where those came from.
Well, thanks, Al. I thank you for noting that dedication. You know, I think you're the first person I've talked to, and I've talked to a number of people, of course, about the book, who's mentioned that. My mother actually passed away just as I was writing the book, and she had been a writer throughout her career, really, throughout her life. She left Barnard College just after the Second World War, and she went into the publishing industry. She wrote for magazines in New York, and she wrote theater reviews and a lot of other very, very interesting things. And she was always terribly encouraging. She used to say, just write what you mean to say. And we all think about writing as a sort of a mystical experience, and we draft and we redraft, and it can become very complex and mysterious. And then finally, you have to sit down, you look at yourself, and I always heard her voice in my mind saying, "Look, just write what you're going to say." And it was terrific. So I felt like I wanted to dedicate the book to her, because she was the model of writing in my life. But you know, the industry, it's a fascinating industry, as you know better than most. You were the leader, really, of an incredibly important airline at Northwest, and during a period of huge formative change in the industry, it's in a way it's a closed box. The airline industry is. It's small enough to get your arms around to sort of see what's happening, but it's big enough to have a huge impact on society and of course on the daily lives of people. And the interesting thing also about it, of course, is that we all have a kind of an emotional response, not just an impersonal kind of economic response, but when people fly, it's a very emotional experience. So there are a number of strands there that really kind of fascinated me.
Well, you mentioned size, and one of the things that comes through in your book, and that I think you described very well, are the various magnitudes that are involved in this industry. 700 million domestic passengers a year, that just 1 cent move in the price of a gallon of jet fuel cost the industry $175 million. The safety record, you have a 1 in a billion chance of fatalities?
Yeah, I think you'd have to. I think there was an MIT professor recently said you'd have to fly every single day for something like 60,000 years. I may not have that exactly right, in order to be involved in a fatality. So it's an amazing record there.
Well, you mentioned that there's quite an amalgamation of characters involved in this industry, and there are a lot of competing interests. There's the airline management, organized labor, which is very, very powerful in this industry, shareholders and creditors. Clearly, this is a very capital-intensive enterprise. Regulators and politicians are all over this industry. You have the aircraft manufacturers who have great power, airports, consumers, and the media. Does anybody, are there any winners here?
Well, my sense is that that it really is a kind of a changing environment, that you see the industry, which was really couldn't find a business model that worked for many, many years, is now, I think, getting to the point where they are starting to make some money. The airlines themselves, I think, in the last quarter, which is always a strong quarter, the third quarter, was making a net profit margin in pretty much in the range of, I believe it was like 4 to 6%, and it's starting to creep into the sort of the mid-range of the S&P average now, and that's unheard of. The idea that an airline would continue to make money across an entire business cycle was considered fantasy until fairly recently. So I think the industry is getting its sea legs finally. They've kind of discovered the law of supply and demand, and they're cutting back on supply. So There are obviously a number of factors having to do, but I do think they are becoming more winners. The question is, what does that mean for the consumers, and how can we make that work as well as making flying a bearable experience for the folks at the back of the bus?
Well, I think you might want to put in perspective what it means for this industry to become profitable. As you point out in your book, in the decade of the 2000s. The industry lost $62 billion.
Yeah.
In 2011, I think it was, or 2010, maybe it made 2% margins, and the subsequent 2 years it was a 0.3% margin. So,
correct.
This industry is, and I think also, as you pointed out in your book, of 57 industries that were kind of listed by Fortune, this was the least profitable. So you might want to comment a little bit on the dynamic of why that's been the case, and what airlines have been up against.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's only very, very recently that they're becoming profitable. And I think. And you would speak to this better than I would, but really the forces of competition, of new entry, of the ease of entry at an earlier stage in this business made turning a profit very difficult. I mean, I think that what we're having now is finally this airline industry was as everyone knows, was deregulated in 1978, and that was just a massive shift. Before that time, the government basically set fares. They set profit margins. The airplanes were half empty, and it all changed overnight. And there's a tremendous amount of new competition, and there was a tremendous amount of oversupply in the industry. And then hit on top of that, of course, in the last 10 years, you have this explosion in fuel prices. Jet fuel prices have really taken it out of the taken any prospect of profitability out of the industry. So, you know, now what's happened is I believe that the industry has really found a new model for operating, where first there are fewer airlines. The industry's consolidated dramatically, which means some degree of pricing power has finally come in. Fuel prices have started to behave, but more to the point, the industry's adapted to higher costs by essentially cutting supply capacity to the point where they're starting to match that with the demand for flying. So my own sense is that we've actually reached a plateau now, kind of a new plateau for this industry, where it is has every prospect of being a decently profitable industry going forward. But again, we do have that issue of how do we do it in a way that the traveler can live with, and that's sort of still an open question. Prices, of course, you know, fares have gone up in the last, but only in the last 3 or 4 years. They're still lower than they were about 11 or 12 years ago, which is pretty amazing. It's hard to think of that for any other commodities has that same experience. So, in the last 3 or 4 years, they have gone up, and the fees have added to the revenue for the industry, and they've made a lot of folks unhappy. But you know, that is probably, we're reaching a kind of an equilibrium point now.
Well, the structural changes that you talk about, particularly affecting supply, have implications for regulation going forward, and I'd like to talk about that in a second. But let's talk a little bit about this pricing. I loved your reference to the dammit price. Why don't you explain what that means how technology has affected this industry. I think you made reference to a 2003 study that someone calculated that if you took an American Airlines flight from Boston to San Francisco over a three-day period, there were 25.4 million fare combinations that you could come up with.
Yeah, it's virtually unknowable. The mathematicians say it's virtually unknowable what the actual cheapest fare is between two points. It's gotten so complex. But as you point out, the technology of pricing the product, the commodity of an airline seat, and that's a whole other issue as to whether it's a commodity or not. But assuming we think about an airline seat as a commodity, that the technology of pricing that with some precision to maximize the price you can charge without deterring the customer from buying that seat has made a huge difference. The term sometimes used is revenue management or yield management. But really, with the advent of high-speed computers, airlines have been able to, and vast stores of history about how a flight has sold out in the past and how it's likely to sell in the future and various trends affecting that flight, it's able to really kind of predict just exactly what price that next seat has to sell at in order to fill the plane close to 100% while charging the most it possibly can. I call that the dammit price. It's the price that you know, you're willing to pay it, but if they raised it $10, you wouldn't pay it, and you take the train, or you damn it, you get in the car with the family and go off to vacation. So the airlines have been able to find that point with remarkable precision, and it's incredibly frustrating for us travelers, of course, because we're not going to get a bargain. There aren't going to be any deals if the airlines are doing their job properly in pricing.
One of the things that certainly you remark on, and it is the experience of travelers, is that flying is not the fun that it maybe it once was 30 years ago. And why don't you talk just a little bit about some of the things that you described in the book, some being such things as the humidity level in an airplane, the effect of crowding, that planes used to fly at 55% of capacity, and now it's well in excess of 85%. And just some of the physical things that go on inside of an airplane today as opposed
sure.
to 30 years ago.
Sure, Al. Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think you focused on probably the key issue, which is crowding. We have, you know, as the airlines have reduced their capacity, the amount of seats, airplanes are more crowded.
I think you noted that it was a 14% reduction in the last 5 years.
Yes, and it's had a direct impact on loads, or the industry calls load factors, the percentage of seats that are sold on each airplane. And so, you know, look, if the average is 85% of the seats are sold, and if you add in various other non-revenue seats, you're looking at pretty much every flight during at popular times between major cities is going to be full or very close to it. And so a full airplane is a very densely packed place. Now, adding to that is the fact that the carriers are reducing the amount of seat pitch, the distance between seats, so that you're kind of scrunched up in there a little bit more. You know, if you take 1 inch away from each seat, each row of seats, and you put it together in an airplane, you've made yourself enough room to add an additional row of seats, which is all, you know, which is pure revenue. So there's every incentive economically to try to tighten it up and crowd airplanes. A crowded airplane is a revenue producing airplane generally. So, you know, for the flyer, that means, you know, it's not just a matter of space, but, and of course Americans aren't getting any thinner either, but it's also a matter of there's a greater likelihood you're going to catch something, you know, from contact germs and so forth. Everybody's touching all the seats and you're hemmed in there. It's really more, you know, you're more exposed to everybody. And so it's difficult. Then of course you're fighting to get your bags in the overhead and you know, all that. So the experience of flight, particularly because of crowding, which is an economically incentivized thing, has gotten worse. You know, it would have been nice to, I'm sure it was nice to fly in an airplane where the average was 55% full. On the other hand, you were paying for it. You're paying for it in two ways. You're paying a higher fare, inflation adjusted, than you are now. In general, and the industry was a mess. Wasn't able to invest anything in new aircraft and so forth. So, you know, the experience is not good for in the back of the bus. But you know, that said, it is getting better in some ways, and technology is, I think, has a prospect at least of improving our experience of flying. New aircraft, in particular. A lot of investment in brand new aircraft, that like the Boeing 787 and the Airbus 380, which have advantages. There's more humidity in the environment of the plane, so you're not getting that horrible sore throat and all the issues people tend to get on airplanes. There's a lower virtual pressurization altitude within the cabin of the airplane, so you're feeling more like you're at 6,000 feet, say, than at 8,000 feet, which is typical in the past, and that altitude difference has apparently had an impact, affects the way people, their headaches and so forth and so on. It's much more comfortable to be at a slightly lower altitude, and these new jets are apparently providing that. So I see technology as really improving the experience. And I have to add also this issue of Wi-Fi and the ability to connect while you're flying long distances. That's really going to be a boon to travelers. So even if you're scrunched up in there and you've got lousy humidity, at least you'll be able to read your emails and do some work. So it's a little bit of a mixed bag.
Well, I think you pointed out that I guess the industry had reached its nadir in the early 2000s when we were really facing almost customer revolts. As you're pointing out, the industry is trying to find ways to make this experience better.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, as you point out, it does allow you to buy your way to comfort. And let's talk about unbundling.
Absolutely. That was one of the great genius responses of the industry. I don't know who thought about it. Maybe it was yours. Did you come up with it?
To plead guilty to that.
Well, it was a genius idea. Somebody said, "Wait a minute, we're not selling transportation. We're not selling your whole experience of transportation, but flying between New York and Washington. We're selling a whole bunch of things in that ticket. We're selling you a seat. We're selling you carrying your bag. We're selling you a snack. We're selling you, you know, a little extra distance for your knees. All that, we're going to take all that, though, now, and we're going to say, let's sell it to you separately." So what's happening now is the airlines have basically taken apart the product they're selling, and they call it unbundling, and selling each of those little parts individually. So you're going to pay $5 for your snack, and you're going to pay $30 or $40 for the to check a bag. You're going to pay. You can buy a few inches. You can buy space by the inch, really, on a lot of airplanes now. That $10 more gets you a few more inches. And what that's meant is that base fares have been very stable. They've gone up somewhat, but they've been over time. They've been pretty stable, but But the so-called ancillary fees, what you pay for these unbundled pieces of your journey, are adding a significant cost and a significant piece of revenue. I think the estimates are it's about $6 billion last year for U.S. airlines was the revenue from baggage fees and change fees. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Which is more than the airlines made.
Absolutely. So that's it. That's your profit. And so it's, that's the new world. There's a question in my mind is there a stopping point with these fees? And, you know, you think there is, but the two of the most profitable airlines in the world are basically the largest chargers of these extra fees, Spirit Airlines or Airways in the United States and Ryanair in Europe. So they've made a lot of money on this. People want the cheapest possible fares. If you they go on Orbitz or Expedia, and they will take the flight that's $5 less expensive, regardless of the fact that may be paying another 30 or 40 bucks or have to check their bag, or may be likely to experience have a flight experience that they don't particularly find very comfortable. So there it is. We say we want one thing, but we're often not willing to pay for it.
Well, but I think you point out that as you kind of buy your way up in terms of comfort and things of this nature, those customers are the ones subsidizing the others. That in point of fact that roundly 20% of the customers are accounting for 70% of the revenues.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that's correct. I think now they're getting to the point where, at least on large aircraft, that a lot of that is revenue above cost. That is, that a lot of the coach seats are actually remunerative now. But you're right. I mean, there's a shift. The people who are paying, the business traveler is paying literally 3, 4, 5, 6 times as much as the coach traveler and back is in fact having a subsidy kind of an impact. I must say the distinctions in pricing have been very high. I mean, literally a business class fare can be 6 or 7 times that of a discount coach fare. But the airlines are trying to provide sort of an interim kind of experience. A lot of them are having this premium economy type seating now where, you know, it's a little more comfortable and you can pay a little bit more. And so I think their theory is, look, there is some choice involved here. Now, at the very high end, there are some amazing, there's a lot of money that the airlines are putting into the premium, the top of the line premium of flying experience, because that's where they're going to make the money. It's, if you want to fly at Singapore Airlines between New York and Tokyo, I think it's something like $10,000. A ticket, but you're going to get, or Emirates Airline, but you're going to get your own little, you know, enclosed suite and your mini bar, and you're going to have a nice mahogany desk there with a large size screen, and they'll make up your bed for you. So it's a pretty good experience if you've got the dough.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing is this stratification of services, and
yeah.
It's. I think that they're probably behind this is a notion that there'll be some sort of trickle-down benefits. You're keeping basic airfares lower for people, and at the same time, there is a certain subsidization going on for those people. And this is what the airlines are playing with.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you, as we kind of wrap up here, you were running the legal department for the FAA with 100 attorneys.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
The FAA is one of the principal regulators of this industry. And I want to ask you a little bit about what you think we can expect from regulation in the future. When the airlines deregulated in 1978, I think there were 30 or 40 airlines.
Right.
Even during my brief period in the industry, I saw them falling. You know, 1 year, 6 went bankrupt, 3 of them liquidated, the rest were absorbed. And we are now down to, 3 major network carriers and a couple big players in the point-to-point flying. I put Southwest in that range.
Sure.
clearly the industry has moved from being highly competitive to an oligopoly.
Correct.
What do you see in terms of the possibilities for re-regulation of the airlines?
Well, it's a really great question. And I would add also that after leaving FAA, I went over to the Department of Transportation, where I was doing more of the aviation policy side on these kinds of questions. So, you know, there really are these two areas of government regulation. One is purely safety, which is really what the FAA is looking into most. And for that, it's, you know, that's pretty constant. I mean, the FAA is really the world's premier safety regulator, and I think in many ways the proof is in the pudding. I mean, there's just, you know, while there are debates between the FAA and the airlines on some cases, they're pretty marginal issues. In most cases, there's a good deal of respect for the FAA, and I think the American public benefits by pretty tough FAA regulation.
Let me interject here. When I was at Northwest in 1990, we had a collision in the midst of a snowstorm on a runway in Detroit, and there were there were a couple of fatalities. The FAA came in, did their inspection, gave us some ideas, and they were absolutely superb. Rather than seeking scapegoats, they were very, very supportive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of good came from that.
Yeah, it's been that's a good relationship, and the FAA, while they're, you know, there are some debates of should they be a little tougher in some cases, and in general, I think they get very good marks across the board, and again, we haven't had a fatal accident in this country in 5 years, with the exception of this Asiana hard landing in San Francisco, where three people died, and one of them was essentially run over by emergency workers, but that's an incredible record. On the other regulatory side, though, the more the transportation department, that's consumer regulation, and there's a real question in my mind, anyway, as to whether whether government has been tough enough on the airlines. Now, you know, there was a feeling, and understandably so, that when the airlines were virtually cratering economically and financially, there was a feeling, look, let's back off a little bit. Let's not make, you know, let's not just aggravate the situation too much. But I think, as you point out, that the early 2000s, we reached a kind of an intolerable level, for travelers. There was the hell of the summer of 2000, where, there were lots of labor issues, particularly with one airline, not the one you were associated with, that caused massive amounts of delays and unhappiness, and things really got out of hand. And I think that the current administration is being a little bit tougher on some of these consumer issues. The one that my book addresses is this so-called tarmac delay issue, which is the when folks get snowed in on a runway and they sit there all night in a regional airplane. It's there was a big fight about at what point do you make a rule that says, look, you got to get the people off the airplane in 3 hours. You know, it may not be a perfect rule, and there's a lot of debate with the industry, but the industry spent 11 years fighting that rule, and in the end it happened, and they probably misplaced their resources on that kind of an issue. So there are things that there are going to be debates with the government and the regulators and the airlines, but you know, these are relatively marginal. There are very, very few people who get stuck on runways, or very few people who spend 3 hours in an airplane, but there are some, and so that is a concern, and keeping a tough regulatory environment, I think, is a good thing for the industry and for the consumer.
Well, one last question.
Sure.
With the reduction of the number of airlines and therefore reduction of competition, what are the chances that we'll see an end to cabotage?
That's a very good point. And I, cabotage, just for whoever's listening, is allowing, foreign airlines to basically fly between U.S. points and carry passengers between two U.S. cities. And that's prohibited by years and years of post-war regulation, international regulation and so forth, on the theory that you should not allow, that basically each sovereign, the United States, its airlines get to carry its passengers within its borders, and the same for France and Italy and everywhere else. And so this has been the big controversy is, look, if you only have three major network airlines in the United States and a Southwest, a point-to-point carrier, a couple of others, where are you going to get competition? And why not let Air Canada fly between Detroit and Miami? Or why not let, you know, a Mexican carrier fly between Houston and Los Angeles?
Singapore do very well coast to coast.
Exactly. Well, you know what? I mean, I never say never, but whenever the U.S., whenever regulators or policymakers have tried to introduce this, there has been hell to pay. It has been a political maelstrom. For one thing, labor views this as a huge threat. For another, the airlines or U.S. airlines are particularly concerned right now about a whole new phenomenon of new entry, very wealthy carriers from the Middle East, who are buying up airplanes hand over fist and are considered an increasing threat by U.S. carriers. I kind of refer to them in something I'm working on now as aerostates, and rather than petrostates. And so we're getting into a whole new area. So as long as that's there, I think that the U.S. industry is not going to be very interested in cabotage. But again, Al, we should talk in about 20 years and see where that goes.
Well, Mark, thank you very much. I thoroughly enjoyed the book, Full Upright and Locked Position, and thanks for writing it.
Oh, well, thank you, Alan. I appreciate that very much. Coming from you, with a guy who had your kind of background at Northwest, I very much appreciate you taking the time.